Accession number 9423, Reel 1.
Mr. Plimmer, Reel 1. Could you tell me when you were born?
I was born on the 25th of July, 1898.
And could you also tell me a little bit about your family? What were your occupation of your parents?
My father was a coppersmith. My mother was an ordinary housewife.
Where did you live at that time?
I lived in Barrow-in-Furness.
Can you tell me, did you have any brothers and sisters?
One brother.
Was he older or younger?
Older.
And how much older?
No more than 2 or 3 years.
And also something about your education.
Well, I went to an ordinary council school.
For how long?
Until I was 14. Mm-hmm.
And what did you do then?
My first job was in an office with Lloyd's Register of British and Foreign Shipping. I stayed there till I went into the shipyard as an apprentice. Plater.
I see, an apprentice plater, which was the same place that your father worked, is that right?
No, different works entirely.
What did the job of apprentice plater entail?
Well, a plater is the man who builds a ship. He bends the frames and plates and sticks them all together, ready for the riveters to knock together.
Can you remember your hours of work at that time?
I used to start work at 6 o'clock in the morning, knock off at 5 o'clock at night. 9.5 hours a day.
And what were you paid for that?
Well, I was an apprentice, only a few shillings a week.
How long would that apprenticeship have lasted?
5 years.
Did you manage to serve your apprenticeship before war broke out?
No, I started in my apprenticeship in 1916, when I was 16 years of age.
Could you tell me in a little more detail about the job of a
Well, the
apprentice?
Job of a ship's plater is to bend the frames and the plates to suit the side of the ship. First of all, they have it in... do it on the floor of a big building where they make templates according to the plans. Then the templates are taken down to the workshops where they bend the frames. The way to bend them is they have a big floor, metal floor, with a lot of holes in there, and they stick a lot of iron pegs in, and they just bend the frames round where these pegs are. These are arranged previously by putting the template down first. And then they bend the ship's frames in the same way. Only they don't do it like that through the on the floor. They do it through rollers. Bend the ship's plates through rollers.
Mm-hmm. Were the plates always heated to be bent?
Not necessarily. No. Sometimes they were, and sometimes they couldn't. You do them without it. It depended upon the thickness of them. You know.
I see. So there must have been a different technique of bending the plates according to. According to their size or the thickness or what?
No, they're the same technique, but where some plates are very thin, you know, 1/8 of an inch thick or something like that, you know.
If it was a very thick plate, how would they bend it?
They bend them in the same way, hot.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You must have been serving your apprenticeship when war actually broke out. Did you notice any change in activity in the shipyard?
Well, there was a big influx of labour from the outlying districts. There was a great deal of work in the town. There was good money going. And they took a lot of people on. Anything, you see. There was a bit of difficulty there, you see. Cause I was going to say before, when the war broke out first, everybody joined the army. They were joining in batches. And nobody bothered to find out what they were doing. And somebody thought, well, this is all wrong, because all our best brains are going in the army, all our best technicians, and they'll probably be more useful at home, you see. So they introduced what they call dilution of labour, taking on people who were semi-skilled, you see. So people were coming in from the outlying districts. They may have been farmers, but they were probably handy with a spanner, and they were taking on in doing the sort of jobs that skilled people used to do before. That sort of thing. That's how they got so many people into the army.
What was the reaction of the trade unions?
It was all agreed with the unions. It was all agreed.
And what about the actual craftsmen? How did they regard this?
Well, they had to go along with the unions. They didn't do first-class work. They did what they call semi-skilled work, you know. I mean, once upon a time, if a fitter went around with a job, he'd have a man with him to carry his spanner sort of thing, you know. Well, all that sort of thing was washed out. The man who carried the spanner became the man who turned the knot up, you know, screwed the knot up sort of thing. This was due to the fact of wanting people to do the jobs, you know.
I take it there was a lot, many more ships being built.
Oh, crikey, yes. Well, as a matter of fact, they built 52 submarines there in the war. 52, one for each month of the war. Several battleships.
How many yards would be in operation?
Only the one yard there. There's only the one yard at Vickers Barrow.
Did your conditions of work change as a result of the war?
No. We started work at 6 o'clock in the morning. Had half an hour for breakfast, half past 8 to 9, I think an hour for dinner. Knocked off at 5. There was a lot of overtime. Lots and lots of overtime. And I had a night shift as well, working regularly all through the nights.
What sort of hours would you work if you took on overtime as well?
Oh, you could work till, usually work till 20 past 8. Then they opened a big shell place there, making shells. Not making them, but, you know, turning shells. On the layers, you know.
Did they actually do night work in the shipyard as well?
I worked on nights and days, yes.
Was there any difference in wages as a result?
Yes, people received what was known as a war bonus. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was a little more on top of the usual wage.
Can you remember thinking before war broke out that there would be a war?
Well, I think that us nippers at school were always aware of the Kaiser's ambitions. And
what made you aware of that?
Newspapers and general talk around the school and that sort of thing. We used to play, instead of playing cowboys and Indians, we used to play Germans and, you know, that sort of thing. We were aware that there was a sort of a nasty feeling between England and Germany. As I say, we knew of the Kaiser's ambitions. He wanted to expand his empire and all that sort of thing.
And how did you come to know of those ambitions?
We knew about them at school. I don't think we were actually taught about them, but it came to our knowledge by talking with them, listening to people, reading papers and that sort of thing.
And did you think of what the war might be?
Never give it a thought, no.
Do you remember the day that war actually broke out?
Yes, I remember it quite well. I think it was August Monday. Well, do you want me to tell me where?
Yes, sorry. What were you doing on that day?
Well, I went to a place called Ulverston where they had a big swimming gala. And I went into this swimming gala. I think it was in the 100 yards. And in the heat in which I took place was the champion. So you can imagine where I came.
Where did you come?
Nowhere.
And what was the reaction of people when they heard the news that war had broken out?
Oh, I think it was a feeling of general euphoria myself. People were running around the streets, singing, shouting, waving flags. I think it was an occasion when everybody thought that it would be a civilised war and that it would be over by Christmas, and everybody who wanted to be into it was, you know, fit enough to go. There wasn't any feeling of despair. I think the people in high places might have been a little bit apprehensive, but the general public didn't take much notice. After all, there had been two wars in the Balkans under in 1912 and 13, and the assassination of the Archduke was just an incident. So that when war broke, I suppose people could be excused for thinking, well, it's just another affair, isn't it? Eh? And when the papers came out and all the names of the battle places were the same old places, Monastir, Adrianople, Scutari, we knew them all, so we thought it was just another little incident. But of course, when it got nearer home, we realised that it was a bit different.
How did you react to the war?
I was like everybody else, full of the joys of life, running around the place. Everybody bought little buttons and waved flags and sang songs and that sort of thing. There was no feeling of despair about it at all.
At that age, you would have been too young to join up, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that?
Well, I don't think I bothered much about it, because everybody had the idea it would all be over by Christmas, you know. Everybody thought it would be, except Lord Kitchener.
Did you feel you'd be left out?
Not particularly, no.
Can you remember the reaction of your friends at that time?
well, my own age, we were probably the same opinion as myself, that it was just a great adventure. And I suppose as time went on, we all thought we'd like to take part in it, you know, and be a part of it.
What about your parents?
Didn't bother much about it.
Because your elder brother would have been old enough to...
He went off to the war, yeah.
Well, how did they react to that?
Nothing. Just swung around and said, my brother's in the army.
And how did your parents feel when he left home to go into the army?
Didn't take much notice of it.
When did you first attempt to join up?
The first attempt was in May 1916. At that time, everybody had what they were known as a national registration card, which said on there whether you was on work of national importance or not. So if you went to the recruiting office and you had one of these, you couldn't get away. So the first time I went there all on my own in ignorance, didn't know anything about this, thought I was going to go into the army, and immediately put me on the reserve, and that's where I stayed. Until later on in the war, the government relaxed this, and the word went round that people were getting away. So I went away with two or three more people in September 17.
And what happened then?
I just went into the army as a private in the infantry.
Which regiment did you join?
I went into the King's Own Royal Lancaster Regiment.
And where did you go to join up?
We joined in Barrow, then went to Lancaster, and then started training at Harwich.
Can you remember the actual thing that you went through when you joined?
At the
recruiting office?
No, when I first joined, I just went and joined up, that's all. A fellow had my previous papers there, and he did one or two more adding to them, and next morning I went to the station and met two or three more people, and away we went to Lancaster. That was the depot of the regiment I joined. And then a day or two there, and we went off.
What did you do whilst you were at Lancaster?
Lancaster.
That's yes. What did you do there?
Well, we just got our equipment and went off to Harwich in Essex for training.
What equipment were you given whilst you were at Lancaster?
Just our kit, clothing, no rifle or anything like that.
And then you said you were put on a train for Harwich?
You went to London and to Harwich.
I see. And what time would that be by the time you were at Harwich?
Well, I did 8 weeks at Harwich. That was a normal training. And then at the end of eight...
What year and month?
What month? Well, I was only in September. So it was October or November. Mm-hmm. At the end of my training of eight weeks, the whole of my platoon was posted to India on garrison duty. I didn't know whether I was pleased or not at that, because like everybody else, I wanted to go to France. Anyhow, we were posted to India, and I got all my equipment, tropical stuff, vaccinated, inoculated, had leave, and we hung around the camp waiting for a boat. And almost at the last minute, about three or four were taken off this draft because they were said to be too young to go to India. And then we were immediately transferred to the machine gun corps.
Why did they feel you were too young?
Well, I suppose they had a minimum age for people to go into. I don't know what it was, 19 or 20. Tropical, you know, climate. We were too young to go to India.
Perhaps before we go on to look at your training in the machine gun corps, we could look at what basic training you underwent at Harwich.
At Harwich.
Mm-hmm. Could you... First of all, begin by telling me something about the actual accommodation that was available.
It was intense, in tents to start with. And then when it got a little bit colder, went into private billets at a place called Parkston.
Can you remember how many slept in the tents?
Not the precise number, but it was pretty crowded. I don't know how many people can occupy a tent, but there wasn't much room when we were in there.
Were they bell tents?
Bell tents, yes.
And in the private billets, could you tell me if families were still there when you were
put in? I think in some of them that the family still lived there, but they sort of gave up a room, emptied a room, and we slept on the floor in the rooms, you know.
Can you remember what the relationship was like between yourselves
and
the
families? They used to give us tea and coffee and stuff like that, cocoa. Very good relations, yes.
And they showed no resentment?
Not a bit, no. Well, they were getting paid for it, weren't they?
Can we just look at the food that you received whilst you were at Harwich?
When I was at Parkston in Billets, we used to go to a cinema on the front there at Dovercourt, where they had a communal mess room. But when we were in tents, we used to go to the cookhouse in a normal manner and take our meals that way.
What food were you given?
Not very good, you know.
In what way wasn't it very good?
Well, it was slapped up any old house sort of thing. Sometimes there wasn't enough of it. It wasn't as good as it was at home, anyway.
Yes. Was there any other reaction you had to the army lifestyle?
Very little at the outset. I just took it in its stride, like everybody else. We were in it, we were glad to be in it, and we just took what we had. We expected it to be rough, and it was rough, but we didn't complain.
In what way was it rough?
Well, the conditions of sleeping weren't very nice, and the weather was cold, and the training was a bit more than we thought we would have to put up with. But otherwise, we just accepted it.
How did you react to the lack of privacy?
Didn't bother me a bit. Not the slightest.
And what about the discipline of...
Well, the discipline was strict. We were very, very strictly disciplined in every way. I mean, after all, we were recruits in training. We were getting ready for a war. We weren't out dancing or anything like that.
Were there any aspects of discipline that you particularly found difficult?
Not at all, no.
Right, can we look then at the actual training that you did at the army, perhaps starting with any basic drill that you were taught?
Well, it was the usual army foot drill, forming fours and all that sort of thing, sloping arms, rifle drill. Then we went through a bombing course, and then a gas course. Then we fired our rifles on the rifle range, and that was about it.
Okay, can we look at them in turn then? You say that the basic drill consisted of marching and presenting arms and so on. How many hours a day would you be expected to do that sort of thing?
All morning and all afternoon.
And how did you react to this marching about?
Not at all, no reaction to it. It was something that we expected. We knew we would have to be trained and march and all that sort of thing. It was nothing unusual in our minds.
Did you find it physically demanding at first?
Not particularly so, no.
And you said you went on a number of courses.
Bombing course. Could you, they weren't courses, they were just ordinary normal training that came in a day's training.
I see. Well, what training did you receive for bombing?
Well, you go into an area, a bombing pit, and you'd be taught how to take the pin out and all that sort of thing, and assemble the bomb and all that sort of thing, and throw the bomb.
How do you mean assemble the bomb?
Well, they've got to be primed. They've got to have detonators put in them and all that sort of thing, you know. And we're taught how to put them in and how to take them out and all that sort of thing. We were taught to manipulate the bomb in every way, other than just pick it up and throw it.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember any of these instructions specifically?
Well, they taught us how to throw it, how to bend ourselves back and get the maximum leverage, and just as though we were bowling or something like that, you know.
Did you have to take a pin out on these bombs?
Yes, though. Yeah, the bombs were live bombs. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. You stood in that trench, and you had a bomb, and you had a drill where you pulled it out like that and floated over. I think you had to count 3 or 4 or 5 seconds or something like that. After you release the bomb, the handle would release the mechanism.
How many seconds fuse was there on the bomb?
About 5 or 6 or 7, something like that. I don't know exactly now. Mm.
Would it vary?
No, not really. Oh, I suppose it would do if it took it very, very finely. But Mills's bomb, you know, there's the handle down. You hold the handle, and when you release the handle, it do. But you can release the handle, but if you've got the pin in, it won't come up. It won't do anything. It's when you take the pin out, the only thing you've got is your own grip on the bomb. And then when you throw it off, or if you just release it, it would go off.
Did you see any accidents?
No.
What other aspects of training were there apart from the bombing and the drill?
Well, we did bayonet training.
Could you describe that?
We used to do stand with our bayonets fixed before a sack and plunge the bayonet into the sack and shout like hell as though you were doing something drastic. Apart from that, they had various manoeuvres, plunging forward and plunging downward and plunging upward and hitting the man with the butt of the rifle and all that sort of thing. A proper drill, proper routine.
Were you given any specific instructions whilst you were sort of charging towards them? Were you told to shout?
Yes, we were told to make as much noise as we could. I think that was in order to frighten the enemy. It didn't seem to me to be like a likely thing to do, but we used to shout.
How long would you do the bayonet practice for?
All the time he was on the bayonet course. It might be a week or something like that.
And also you did, presumably, rifle practice.
Yes, we used to do rifle every day. We practiced the rifles, firing, you know, but not with live ammunition. The only time we fired with live ammunition was when we went on the rifle range.
Can you remember what instructions you were given?
On the rifle range. Well, we'd had preliminary instruction in how to load a rifle and how to fire and how to aim and how to aim off in case of a wind and all that sort of thing. And then when we went down on the firing range, we just laid down on the ground and we got 5 rounds of ammunition and the target went up and told to fire.
Did you get to see what results?
Oh, yes, the signal by a device.
Can you remember what you got?
Not very well, no.
Were you a good or a bad shot?
Medium.
A medium. And what other training were you given apart from the ones that you've already mentioned so far?
Well, we're given training in gas.
Oh, yes.
Adjusted gas respirators and all that sort of thing.
Could you describe that?
Well, everybody had a gas respirator, a small box respirator, and we used to get somebody to shout gas, and we had to take our mask out of our case and stick it on there and all that sort of thing. 2 or 3 seconds.
Did you have any practice with real gas?
Not then, no.
It came later on?
No, but when I joined the army after the war, when I rejoined the army, I went to Porton once and they had people walking through chambers with gas just to give them a sniff of it. But I never sniffed any at all in England before I went abroad.
I see. And also, were you given any special training at that time whilst you were at Harwich?
No, I was just trained as an ordinary infantryman. People who had special training would be people like signallers and things like that. No, I didn't have any of that.
And did you go on any route marches?
Several of them.
You did?
Oh, yes.
Can you remember them?
Well, they were just ordinary walks, about 10 miles, and increasing it to about 15. Finally finishing with about 20, something like that.
What did you have to carry whilst you were on these route
marches? Full marching order.
Which consisted of what?
Pack. With all your gear in there, everything, rifle, bayonet, it was murder.
It was? Mm. In what way was it murder?
It's a long walk, isn't it? And these things are very heavy. The straps cut your shoulder. The packs, they feel like a ton on your back by the time you're finished. And then, of course, your feet hurt.
Mm-hmm. Really, did you take any sort of precautions to try and stop your feet blistering?
No, I didn't. No, I was very fortunate. I didn't have any foot trouble of any kind.
What sort of things did the men do to try and avoid foot trouble?
Well, they used to put soap in the socks there, and that was an old soldier's trick. And some people's heels used to rub them very badly, and they used to try and put stuff down there. But I didn't have any trouble at all in mine.
Was there any means of breaking in your boots to make them more
well,
supple?
Well, you wore them all day long. You wore them regularly.
And when you were on these marches, how often did you have rests as you walked along?
Well, it's supposed to give you 5 minutes every hour. I don't know if it's 5 or 10 minutes every hour. And sit down by the side of the road and take your pack off. And off you go again.
Did you have to march in step?
Not always, but generally speaking, it's better to march in step. You can march at ease, you know, not carrying your rifle, march at ease, but march in step. It's much easier to march in step.
Why is it much easier to march in step?
Well, if you're walking in a crowd, you're in a rabble, you don't know whether you're doing a tango or what.
How do you mean?
Well, you might, if the man in front might be out of step with you, he might kick his heels. The man behind might do the same to you.
Yeah, so you were in a formation as you marched along.
Oh, we marched in fours in those days, in fours, all in step.
Did you do anything to keep your spirits up as you were marching along?
Oh, there was a great deal of banter going on, and ribaldry and all that sort of thing. When we were marching at ease, people were talking to each other. People were allowed to smoke at times. Not all the time, but they were given permission to have a little smoke now and again. And then there were people who were singing songs, popular songs of the day, and other songs which I don't remember. I know they were written by Lennon and McCarthy, for instance. Songs that were originated in, probably in India.
Now what do you mean by they originated in India?
Well, they were all soldiers' songs, you know, songs of song by people who sang them long before the war broke out. They weren't new songs. Uh-huh. There may be one or two songs.
Can you remember any of them now?
We used to sing one song, When This Blessed War Is Over, Oh, How Happy We Shall Be.
Oh, right. Turning to taking care of your equipment and the kit, could you describe what you had to do?
Well, kit inspections was a regular feature, probably once a week, in which case everybody laid all the kit out on the floor and somebody came round and inspected it. As regards keeping equipment clean, we had to do that. We had to keep all our buttons clean, boots clean, all our brushes on our equipment were clean, and we had to blank all the webbing. We had to do it whatever we could. Or we used to probably do it on the benches where people washed themselves when they weren't being, you know, used for that purpose. Yes, we had to do that, keep them clean.
How would it take you to clean up the kit after being out of march?
It would depend upon the man's ability. Some people could do it twice as quick as other people. It didn't take a great deal of time. If he kept it clean, it didn't want so much attention as if he left it when it was dirty.
Yes, could you describe how you laid out your kit in a kit inspection?
Well, I think we used to lay it on a blanket, and everything used to be in its own particular place. Shirts and stuff at one part, and boot brushings at the other part, and all that sort of thing. Everything in its proper place. There was a pattern at which everybody had to follow. I suppose that was so that when a bloke come round to look at it, he could see at a glance whether it was there or not. Otherwise, if it was put down in any way, he would have to search for what he was looking for.
Mm-hmm. And can you remember what happened if your kit wasn't complete?
Well, if it wasn't complete, somebody would tell you to go and draw some from the stores and you'd have to pay for it.
That ever happened to you?
No, I don't think so. Nobody ever pinched anything off me. I didn't pinch up anything with anybody else.
Mm-hmm. And just one moment, I forgot to mention about cleaning rifles and so on. What did you have to do to
keep rifle cleaning order? Was a very, very important thing. To say the rifle's a man's best friend. That used to be have to be kept meticulously clean. They were inspected every day, and if there was a little bit of dust on them, the sergeant would get onto you. They used to look down the barrel. The barrel had to be shine like silver. But when you fire the rifle on the range, you just have to boil them out. You have to put boiling water down the barrel so as to open the pores, then use your pull through and pull out the surplus stuff that was deposit, you know.
Mm-hmm. Where was the cleaning equipment kept for the rifle?
Well, your own private stuff, that was. I mean, you used to keep it in your own private kit in your tent. But when you were on the ranges, they used to have hot boiling water there on the ranges. That was a different thing altogether.
Oh, so you actually clean them once you finish using them?
Yes.
There and then.
Mm. See, after you've fired them, it leaves a lot of deposit on the barrel. And boiling water opens the pores and this pull through clears it a bit.
After you completed your 8-week course at Harwich, what happened to you next?
Well, I was transferred to the Machine Gun Corps. Their headquarters were at Grantham, Harrowby Camp Grantham. I think I stayed there for about a night or two, and then I went off to Clipston Camp, which is near Mansfield. I spent about a month there. Then I went from there to Belton Park, which is, I don't know where the nearest place to Belton Park was, but I was there about a fortnight, then I went out to France.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if you could work our way through those different locations and what happened to you there. Were you still in the same battalion there of the King's Own?
No, I was entirely transferred away from the King's Own.
So what unit were you in there?
The Machine Gun Corps.
And that was not attached to any particular...
No, the Machine Gun Corps. I got a different regimental number and everything.
I see. Okay, so your first port of call then was Grantham. What happened to you at Grantham?
Oh, we were simply nominated to a unit in Clipston, that's all. That was, and took down all the particulars at Grantham. That was their headquarters. I did no training there.
I see. What unit were you put in?
Into, I don't know. Well, what unit? Just a training battalion at Clipston.
Oh, I see, okay. And you'd stayed at Grantham for...
About a day.
Oh, I see. Right, we can turn now to Clipston Camp. Could you describe the camp?
Well, it's a camp, it's near Mansfield, about, oh, I don't know. But we used to walk into Mansfield, so it can't be all that far away. It was just an ordinary camp, hutted, by the way, hutted camp. And all they did there was teach you how to use a machine gun.
What was the accommodation in the huts like?
Pretty good. Better, far better than it was at Harwich.
In what way was it better?
Well, we lived in stores, under in